It's time for another edition of Rockin' the Boat. My name's the V-Man, and today I'm joined by Freak Radio's old lady Scar Arms. On the program today, we'll be talking about the life of Rachel Corrie, the International Solidarity Movement activist who was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer. We'll discuss her legacy and get a reaction to the latest news on her case from Rachel's parents, Craig and Cindy Corrie. Stay tuned.
Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old student at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, had been living in the occupied territories of the Gaza Strip as a member of the International Solidarity Movement, a Palestinian-led movement of international activists utilizing nonviolent direct action tactics to raise awareness of the struggle for Palestinian freedom and an end to Israeli occupation. On March 16, 2003, Rachel Corrie was in the town of Rafah in Gaza, attempting to prevent an Israeli military bulldozer from demolishing the home of a Palestinian doctor whom she had befriended and taken up residence with. After a tense standoff between Rachel and the driver, she sat down in the dirt 20 feet in front to block its path. Despite her nonviolent resistance, the bulldozer lurched forward, pushing up dirt as it came close to her. Rachel, clad in a bright orange vest and shouting to the driver through a megaphone, climbed up on the pile and was eye level with the driver as he continued forward, pushing her until the mound under her gave way and she went into the pile of earth.
As the other activists witnessing this came running, the driver continued pushing until Rachel was under the blade of the bulldozer. Then, after a slight pause, backed away without lifting the blade, so it hit Rachel Corrie again. She was pronounced dead at the hospital a short time later. Shortly after the killing, the Israeli government stated that Rachel Corrie's death was a, quote, regrettable mistake, unquote. Now, more than 3 months later, the Israeli military has officially exonerated the soldier who killed Rachel Corrie. The Israeli military report, released on June 26th, states in part, quote, the crew of the armored bulldozer did not see Miss Corrie, who was standing behind a pile of earth, nor could they have seen or heard her, end quote. Today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll talk about Rachel's legacy and get a reaction to the latest news from her parents, Craig and Cindy Corrie, who are joining us by telephone from Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you both for being with us tonight here on Rockin' the Boat. I wish that the circumstances didn't bring us together, but here we are. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Maybe you can begin. We can begin with you, Cindy Corrie. Tell us about your daughter, Rachel. You probably knew her more, you know, better than anyone in the world. So give us an idea of who Rachel Corrie was.
Well, I feel like I knew her pretty well, but there have been interesting things that I've learned about Rachel since her death, because I think all parents can relate to the fact that when your children become adults, and particularly because she was living in Olympia, Washington, and we had lived there most of our lives, our adult lives, but had to move away a few years because of a job change. So we weren't there with her every day watching what she was doing. But she was a gift to us. She was our youngest child. And I think to every member of our family, she always added a lot of surprise and interest and love and gentleness. She was 5 years younger than her sister and 7 years younger than her brother, and from the day she was born, from the moment she was came into their lives, she was very special to them, as she was to her father and I. She grew up in Olympia, and she I feel like she was really formed, you know, she brought her own perspective to things, but she was really impacted by our community in Olympia, Washington, a very rich community, and one where...
Rich in the things that one could do and the people that are in it. I don't think it's particularly rich in the sense of a lot of money.
No, but it was just a very supportive place for her to grow up. She went to school in the Olympia Options Program as an elementary school student. That's an alternative program within the public school system. and it emphasized connections to the community and connections to the world. And she did a lot of writing there, a lot of thinking there. So that was kind of the beginning, I think, of some of her activism. And although we didn't really think of it that way so much, but I think it did have its beginnings there. When she was a fifth grader, she participated in a press conference on world hunger with all of her other classmates. That was at the state capitol. So she learned quite early about taking a stand on important issues. And then she was, through her high school years, we had exchange students living with us in our house. After our older children had gone off to college, then we felt that we had some room so that we could have exchange students live with us. And we had three during Rachel's high school years, one from Brazil, Gustavo, and Anyuta from Russia, from the Russian Far East, the Sakhalin Islands, and Saiko, who came from Japan, and that was during Rachel's senior year in high school. So she always had a connection to other places, too. And then she attended the Evergreen State College, and it took her a while. She took kind of a long path through Evergreen. Work was very important to her. I think always doing more, connecting to the community and connecting to people in places other than just at school was important to her. She took a year off and worked for the Washington Conservation Corps and went with crews to build trails in the Olympic National Park and in Mount Rainier National Park. They would clear campgrounds. They would work on fishing streams. And once I remember there was a group of young people that came over to learn something about our park system, and Rachel really enjoyed their time there. And in fact, after she died, we heard from some of those young people. So she had that experience. She also, while she was at Evergreen, worked with a community mental health agency in Olympia called Behavioral Health Resources, and worked for a place called Hospital Diversion House, where she worked with mental health clients and developed a drop-in program for those clients. So she was very connected to her community as well as to the school, and really, I think, worked at building those connections and helped people at Evergreen build those connections. In her final, I know one of her final jobs was working with students at Evergreen that were new to the school, and they would do projects in the community, and Rachel actually worked with them because she knew the community well, so she was able to connect them to places. And, of course, then she, after 9/11, became very involved in the peace movement and decided she wanted to work seriously as a peace activist, and it was through that work that she connected to a group that was working on peace in the Middle East.
And would that be the International Solidarity Movement? Would that be the ISM?
The ISM did have a presence in Olympia. There is one of the coordinators for ISM is in Olympia. Phan Nguyen is his name. She certainly connected with that group there in Olympia. And there were others from Olympia who went to Palestine last summer with Freedom Summer, so she knew others who had gone directly, was able to talk with them, heard their reports back, and so forth. But she was also working with people who had been in the occupied territories many years ago, who had a long history of working on this issue, and also one of her mentors who works with the Peace and Justice Studies Association at the Evergreen State College is Simona Sharoni, who is an Israeli woman who came to the United States, I think, when she was about 29 years old to study and has remained here, but has really worked on this issue all of much of her life. So Rachel had a lot of people around who had a lot of experience and knowledge about the situation.
Why did Rachel choose to go to the occupied territories? She could have worked from Olympia, Washington, with the ISM or another group that was working on the issue. There's things people can do from the United States. What do you think it was that attracted Rachel to the International Solidarity Movement and actually to travel physically to the occupied territories and work there with the Palestinian people?
Well, I think she had traveled some. She actually went to Russia, for example, after we had a Russian student with us. She went and spent 6 weeks in Russia. That was a life-changing experience for her, and she saw firsthand, I think, when she got there, the hardship that people were living with there. And I think for the first time it really awakened in her a sense of what her privilege was as an American. And she came back, and I think things were never quite the same for her. But I think she had a strong desire to connect directly with people and to do things that she felt, to really make an important difference. And I think that actually going there was really a natural outgrowth for the kinds of work that she was doing in Olympia, working in the peace movement, working against the war in Iraq and so forth. But I would just say that because of some of her previous experiences, I'm sure that just to sit in Olympia and to hear about it, even though she would be working on it, and I don't mean to underestimate the value of people working from here at all, but I'm sure, given the previous experiences that she had, that going and making that direct connection was something she felt she could and should do.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Rockin' the Boat. My name's the V-Man. I'm joined by Old Lady Scararms, and we're speaking with the parents of Rachel Corey, Craig and Cindy Corey, who are joining us by telephone from their home in North Carolina. I wanted to maybe bring in Craig Corey into the discussion. First, could you tell us how long Rachel had been in the occupied territories, and maybe what kinds of work was she doing there?
Well, she'd been there since about the middle of January is when she went there, and she was doing some of the things that maybe more traditional with the, well, maybe I'm saying that wrong, but at any rate, she several of the things that she did are the things you might think of, so that she was, for instance, she would stay at a well. The Israeli army, either with their bulldozers or their tank, but they would they damaged one of the wells actually before Rachel got there. And when the Palestinian water workers came to repair the well, they would be harassed with gunfire from the wall that's being built between Rafah and Egypt. So there are towers along that wall, and these people would fire from there. So the ISM would go out, and Rachel was one of them, with their banners and their shirts and their megaphones, and try to make a presence so that the municipal water workers could rebuild that well and connect it back in with the water supply. She might sleep also at that well at night to see that it was not further damaged. She also, as you mentioned before, slept in some of the homes. As that wall is being built along, it's my understanding, we've not been there to see it, but it's along the border, not right on the border with Egypt, but back away from the border. And as that wall is being built, and it is approximately, I'm told, about 11 meters high and 8 meters deep into the ground. And as it is being built, then the Israelis are clearing the ground away from that wall towards the city of Rafah. So they are bulldozing down the homes that were there, because that was all one large municipal area, in fact, on both sides of the border. And of course, when they do that, they just come in and bulldoze down a home. It's not like in the United States where you go through a process of law to to take the home and be compensated for that house and things like that. They just come in and bulldoze it down, and you have maybe a few minutes, maybe not, to get out some of your belongings. So some of the members of the ISM would sleep at night in these homes that they thought would be the most likely to come under that sort of bulldozer attack. And Rachel had slept on the floor in the back room of Dr. Samir's home with his three children, and she wrote about that, waking up in the morning and seeing gummy bears dubbed into Arabic on TV, and this, as she calls it, a puddle of blankets for these children. She also would she talked to people in the community, met families that became her friends. She would, particularly while she was staying at home, she might try to learn Arabic from the children as she tried to teach them English, so she'd have an exchange that way. When she got to Gaza, she noticed the beautiful handwork of the many of the women in the Gaza Strip and in Rafah, and seeing that, she had emailed back to a fair trade store in Olympia, hoping that she could arrange for their hand goods to be sold in the fair trade store. She, before she left to go there, she had collected letters from children in the grade school she herself had attended years before. She went back to it, collected some letters, and was getting these letters translated into Arabic, and then the plan was to have them emailed into Rafah and start a pen pal program. And now there are a lot of people in Olympia and people in Rafah that are working to make some of those exchange, like the pen pal exchange and the economic exchange, the fair trade exchange, and some other things come alive in sort of a unofficial sister city relationship that we're trying to get going there. So that's some of the things that she did there. She was very engaged in the community there, just like she had been in Olympia. And I think felt a great deal of warmth for, as she wrote, for the people there.
Craig, there was a local letter to the editor here in Santa Cruz about a couple of months ago, that in which a local man wrote that Rachel Corey was defending terrorists when she was standing in front of the doctor's home. He also stated that she brought this upon herself. If you had the opportunity to respond to this individual, what do you think you would say?
Well, I think that person has to recognize that the people are real. You know, if you want to be specific, when she was in front of that home, I don't know whether he's accusing the doctor, his wife, or one of the three small children as being a terrorist. But, of course, that's absolutely untrue. There's nothing that anybody officially has ever said to us. Of course, there are people out trying to make out that every Palestinian is a terrorist, but of course we've met many Palestinians and Palestinian Americans. They have very warm family values, wonderful people. So that part of it is just people use the word terrorist to try to stop understanding. They try to stop conversation with that. And what we need to do is have more understanding about the situation. We have, of course, talked to people, in fact, fairly high, really very high in the State Department about this, and there's no, there's nobody in our State Department that accuses the, certainly in this situation, or I've ever heard really accuse the ISM of protecting terrorists. And in fact, in the last meeting we had with the State Department, one of the gentlemen who had spent time in Jerusalem, had just gotten back from Jerusalem, stopped us on the way out and said, I have great respect for the ISM and the members of the ISM that I met while I was in Jerusalem. So, you know, that perspective is near as I can tell, certainly not one that is shared by our government or anything like that, and it's not something I've heard. I think that people have to understand that ISM, it was formed actually after Mary, what's her last name?
Mary Robinson.
Mary Robinson in the UN. I think she's a High Commissioner for Human Rights.
She was.
She was. And she had called for human rights observers to go to the occupied territories and in hopes of calming the violence there. Several years ago she called for that, and that request was vetoed by the United States, Israel, and two other countries. So ISM was formed to help Palestinians nonviolently resist the occupation of their own lands. And I think we all have to think that if we don't support the nonviolent resistance to that occupation, then what message does that send? If nonviolence doesn't work, if they feel that nonviolence doesn't work, then what does that leave for him? And, of course, Rachel went, and I'm convinced she, I know Rachel went there thinking, and I absolutely agree, that she not only was protecting Palestinians by this nonviolent resistance to the occupation, but she was protecting Israelis and, in fact, U.S. citizens as well.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Rockin' the Boat. My name's the V-Man, and I'm joined today by Old Lady Scar Arms. We're speaking with the parents of Rachel Corrie, who was murdered March 16th by an Israeli military bulldozer in the city of Rafah in the occupied territories. On June 25th, the military released a report which exonerated the killers of your daughter. You met with the Israeli ambassador to the United States the day prior. Surely he must have mentioned something about this report to you and that the fact that the soldier was exonerated. Am I right?
Well, I think that we'd known that the soldier was exonerated. We talked to the ambassador. I'd like to correct you on one thing. Unless they've actually released the report to the press, I think they probably made some sort of statement. But to our knowledge, the report has not been released. The ambassador did promise us that the report would be released, but it has not been. Some members of the embassy in Tel Aviv have been allowed to read the report and take notes on it, but to my knowledge, nobody in the U.S. government has seen that other than those two people. They have not released the report. It's not like I can look at the report or that, in fact, somebody in our State Department can read over that report and look at it and see how those words reflect with the other things that we know. So as far as I know, the report has not been released.
And the United States government has asked for the report. At least we know that the people in the American embassy did request that the report be released to them, but the Israelis have declined to release that report to members of the U.S. government.
Now, the Israeli government stated, quote, "The crew of the armored bulldozer did not see Miss Corrie, who was standing behind a pile of earth, nor could they have seen or heard her," unquote. Now, how would you respond to that, to the claim that the driver didn't see Rachel, that it was just an accident?
Well, you know, Craig talked with eyewitnesses immediately, soon after the incident, and talked with two different people at two different times, which he can talk about. But the ISM had been working in that area. There were at least seven activists there that afternoon, and they had been working there for several hours. And they had done this kind of thing on other occasions as well. During the course of the afternoon, the bulldozers would come up and actually come up to their feet. I mean, the activists would do the very same things that Rachel did, which were, first of all, to be out in front of the bulldozer some distance far away from quite away from the bulldozer as it approached, and then as it did approach, to kneel or to sit somehow. But I've read descriptions that what she did was actually to kneel to show their intention not to move, and that the bulldozers would come right up to the feet of the people there and then stop. And so it seems very strange to me that if they were able to do that through the entire course of that afternoon, why they would not be able to do the same for Rachel, particularly when she was had an orange jacket, a bright jacket with reflective striping on it. The eyewitnesses said that the light was good. It just seems strange to me that they would not have been able to see her.
And of course, you know, there are two bulldozers and either an armored personnel carrier or a tank. I'm not sure which it's really is, but there are three vehicles out there, all of whom are in contact with one another through radio. There are two people in each of those bulldozers. There's the actual operator and then the commander, and of course, it's that commander's job to be looking in whatever areas that you can't see. And I would say it's the overall commander, who I believe is in the armored vehicle, the tank, is his responsibility to make sure that it's safe out there. I'm a Vietnam War veteran. I was with the 8th Engineers attached to the 1st Air Cavalry in Vietnam in 1970. So part of my duties was to be in charge of bulldozer operations. And as the ambassador and the person that reported to us last week was saying, you know, that they tried to do what they can and nobody wanted this to happen. But I assured him, and I can assure you, that where I was and under my command, it would not have happened. It's a soldier's responsibility to know what's in front of that blade. And there's just very little excuse for that. I think that one of the things that their story doesn't say, but I believe from the eyewitness accounts, that, you know, the mound of earth they're talking about is what the bulldozer was making as it approached her. It's being pushed and, of course, like I say, in all other instances, stopped right as it got to the person. But in this case, Rachel, what I was told by an eyewitness, is managed to scramble after she found out that it wasn't stopping, managed to scramble to the top of this earth, which, of course, the thing that she's confronted with is it's falling at the front edge of that earth. It kicks up by the blade and then falls. So she managed to get on top of that. It's the only place she could go, but I was told managed to get her shoulders and her head above the blade and be looking into the cab when whatever her footing gave way and she was pulled underneath the blade, and like your report said, then they stopped and then backed over, and still apparently their report says that she was not hit actually by the bulldozer. Yet the whole world has seen the pictures of her laying in those tracks and the reports. So I think that their report, for one thing, creates more questions than it answers, and shows even more dramatically why we need a U.S. investigation into Rachel's death.
At www.palsolidarity, that's palsolidarity.org, you can read eyewitness accounts. There were 8 eyewitnesses to the killing of Rachel Corey, and they all have the same story. She was making eye contact with the driver. Despite the fact that they rushed forward, he continued to drive over Rachel. You can read their eyewitness testimonies at palsolidarity.org. We just have a couple more minutes here, Craig and Cindy. I'm going to ask you just a couple more questions, if you can answer as briefly as possible. I'm sorry, we're running out of time here. Do you know anything about the individual who's driving the bulldozer? Do you know his name? If you had a chance to say something to him, what would it be?
We don't know his name. It's my understanding that he is from Russian area, is the old Soviet Union area. I guess Cindy talked about that she just wished he, instead of running over Rachel, that he'd gotten off that bulldozer and talked to her, because he would have met a wonderful human being.
This is probably one of the hardest interviews I've ever had to do here on Free Radio Santa Cruz in my 8 years of broadcasting. I really appreciate you both being so brave and courageous to come on and talk and carry on your daughter's legacy. It's a really horrible thing what happened, and I hope it never happens again to any other human being. Maybe you can give our listeners in the final minute that we have some contact information for how they can put pressure on this government to carry out a really truly independent investigation into the death of your daughter.
We are asking people to contact their members of Congress, their congressmen, and to ask them to support HCR 111. That's House Concurrent Resolution 111, which calls for an American investigation into Rachel's death. We would also encourage people to contact their senators and to urge them to see that a similar resolution in the Senate becomes introduced, also calling for an American investigation into Rachel's death.
Also, they can contact the Department of State, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the White House, calling for a U.S. investigation, and they can also contact the Israeli embassy and show that the American people expect cooperation with U.S. investigation, and we would, of course, expect them to live up to the promise that Sharon made President Bush the day after Rachel was killed, that they would provide us with the investigation that they have done.
We are flat out of time. I want to let listeners know they can contact you and find out more information about Rachel Corrie by visiting the Rachel Corrie Memorial website, and that's rachelcorrie.com, and that's spelled C-O-R-R-I-E, rachelcorrie.com. I really thank you, Craig and Cindy Corrie, for being with us here on Rockin' the Boat.
Thank you
so much for having us.